Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are going to take a look at Iraq in the first part of our program today. We had scheduled it what we thought would be a really interesting debate and discussion between a centrist thinker, a liberal thinker who probably backs President Barack Obama's ideas, on the one hand, and Phyllis Bennis, who is director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of Ending the Iraq War, a Primer, and Ending the War in Afghanistan, a Primer. But the centrists couldn't make it, but Phyllis Bennis is here. Phyllis, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Thanks. Great to be with you, Mark.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888 to join in on this conversation. So maybe I'll have to play devil's advocate here than I do in the course of this conversation, Phyllis. let me just kind of ask you. I saw the piece that you wrote on the IPS website, Institute of Policy Studies website, about your reactions to President Barack Obama's speech and what you thought was not in it that should have been in it.
Right. Well, there were in some ways more important things not said than what was said. President Obama did say one important thing, which I had not heard from a high-ranking administration official. So that was a good thing. He acknowledged that the Iraq War is now a trillion-dollar war.
Mm-hmm.
Horrifying reality and not one that is usually acknowledged. So that was important. He spoke in the speech also about the cost of war in this country to people struggling with job loss, with no health care, with bad education, all those things. Unfortunately, one of the things he didn't say was the link between them. He didn't say that the cost of keeping 50,000, yes, combat troops in Iraq through the end of next year, which will be about $12.5 billion, is the same amount of money that could otherwise be used to fund 240,000 new green union jobs. So that was a disappointment, although it was important, as I mentioned, that he did acknowledge the trillion-dollar cost. Among the things, though, that he didn't say what we know to be true, that the 50,000 troops are indeed combat troops. They have been, in the words of the Pentagon, remissioned, meaning that their title is no longer the such-and-such combat brigade. They are now things like the such-and-such assistance and training brigade. But they're the same soldiers with the same gear doing the same thing. He talked a lot about the 4th Striker Brigade, what he said was the last combat brigade to leave Iraq. He didn't mention the 3,000 troops of the 3rd Armored Cavalry Brigade who only deployed to Iraq a week ago last Sunday out of Fort Hood in Texas that included a number of young soldiers who have already been diagnosed with PTSD or traumatic brain injury. It's a horrific reality. He didn't mention that of the 50,000 troops remaining, 4,500 of them are U.S. Special Forces troops. They have two jobs, both of which are pretty bad for us to be saying we're not having any combat anymore. One is they still are carrying out direct counterterrorism operations, which means they have something called a kill and capture list. They run around the country. Anybody they come across whose name is on that list, pretty much regardless of what the intelligence was that put them on that list, was it somebody looking to settle old scores? Was it somebody looking for money from a bounty? Whatever it was, if they're on that list, they have authority to kill or capture them. If that wasn't bad enough, they are also training their counterparts in something called the Iraq Special Operations Force, a military force of also about 4,500 people, answerable basically only to Prime Minister Maliki, not to the Iraqi parliament, even the rest of the government, and who are being trained by U.S. generals whose pride in what they're training is based on the models we saw in the 1980s in El Salvador. The Brigadier General Simeon Trombitas, who's the commander of the Iraq National Counterterror Force Transition Team, who's training these Iraqi special forces, says that they continue to have, quote, advisors at every level of the chain of command. And he says he served in both El Salvador and Colombia. He said, we are very proud of what was done in El Salvador and said that those training missions are, quote, extremely transferable to Iraq. Well, those training missions, if you all remember from back in the 1980s, trained a set of death squads who wreaked havoc on the civilian population of El Salvador. If that's what's being planned in Iraq, we're going to be in serious trouble way beyond the end of next year.
Phyllis, I a number of questions I have about this, and I think that there, We had a conversation yesterday with a man whose name is Imad Al-Kahafaji. And just a little background. Before we play
Imad.
This 90s, you know Imad?
Mm-hmm.
And for our listeners, those who didn't hear me yesterday, Imad is known in Baghdad as the most popular radio talk show host in Baghdad. And he talks to the street people and the men and women in the street and the communities, working class people. And he suffered 3 or 4 years in Saddam's prisons before the invasion of Iraq because he was a left-wing student who organized workers and students against the dictatorship. And he talked to us about the mixed emotions people have in Iraq about this. But let me just play this very short clip from Imad, clearly torn about all this, and I'd like just to have your response to it.
If you could sit with President Barack Obama and the people making policies in America, what would you say to them about what should happen now?
If it's up to me, I would say it's not the right time. It's good to keep your promises, but it's not the right time. At least let them have a clear government or a government at least. Let Iraqis have something, okay, and then say, okay, we did our part, the rest is your part. But not to leave them halfway. They are, until today, they don't know what kind of a government or what kind of a prime minister we will have or a president. This is a problem. This is a problem. I don't know. Iraqi people feel, although they are against what happened, maybe President Bush did something that Iraqis, not all Iraqis are agreeing with, but they feel that President Obama is leaving them to some evil people who are in power in Iraq without saying goodbye.
Phyllis, there was more, but I don't want to belabor that. I just want you to hear that piece, and we can talk a bit more about that.
It's consistent with what Imad has said since the first day of the war, so it's not a surprise. But I think that what is important to recognize is that he raises all the right points about the horror show that is life in Iraq today. The problem that I have with his conclusion is the notion that somehow the U.S. occupation remaining is going to make it any better. It simply isn't. If the current government, which isn't really the current government, it's a caretaker government, because after 6 months, the Iraqi parliament has been unable to agree on a government, I think there's a serious problem of representation, whether the Iraqi people are well represented in their government. I don't think they are. The question of what will happen to this government if the U.S. pulls out is a very important question, because in my view, if this government is dependent on the U.S. military remaining in place, it means it doesn't have enough independent legitimacy to remain on its own, and so it should disappear. It's not up to us to say what kind of a government Iraq should have, who should be running it. There was a terrible statement day before yesterday when Vice President Biden had gone to Iraq for the handover ceremony to the new commander-in-chief, the new shift from so-called Iraqi freedom to the equally scary-sounding New Dawn operation. And Vice President Biden's top national security advisor, Mr. Blinken, I'm forgetting his first name, said publicly when he was asked about the various coalitions that are competing for a primary role as in forming a government in Iraq, the coalitions within the Iraqi parliament, and he was asked about the coalition led by Muqtadir al-Sadr, who, of course, was one of the leaders of the anti-occupation militias and political party in Iraq. And his answer was, the only coalitions that should be part of the government are those that support a strong partnership with the United States. And I wanted to say, well, excuse me. Who gets to say that? Why is it that we get to tell the Iraqis that the only legitimate members of their government are those who support a strong partnership with the United States? What about all those Iraqis who want nothing to do with the United States? You know, so this notion that somehow, I mean, Imad was saying one very important thing, and that is that we owe a huge debt to the people of Iraq,
right,
which goes way beyond pulling out the troops. But in my view, we can't begin the process of making good on those commitments until we can pull out the troops. That's the key. That's the key. And I think that that's what we have to, you know, that's what we have to look at. During the early years of the war, when the pro-war people were always arguing, oh, you people just want to cut and run, I always felt that even though for them it really was a way of justifying the war, there was a germ of truth in it that was really important, which was to recognize what we have done to that country, not only in this war, but in the last war and in the 12 years of crippling sanctions in between. And the result of all of that is that we owe a huge debt. We owe a debt of reparations, a debt of reconstruction, but we don't owe occupation. And as long as that occupation is continuing, we can't make good on those other obligations.
How do you think in your analysis of what's going on in Iraq, we do make good on that? I mean, when you mentioned a bit ago Simeon Trombetas, who you, I think, wrote about it in your piece for IPS, mm-hmm. and many of us remember all too well the death squads of El Salvador. One of the things Imad was talking about was the fact that in, and other people I've talked to in Iraq, is that there is no democracy in Iraq. People are put in jail for demonstrating. They are stopped every time they try to organize a union. All these things are going on. And you have us training death squads in Iraq in a Maliki government that clearly doesn't want to give up power. So, I mean, this is...
Sounds about right.
And so then what is... How do we then interpret our responsibility to what we've wrought on Iraq and what our next step is then?
I think our first step is to get the military out. Then we begin a process, which I hope will go on for years, of support for civil society in Iraq through money, through training, through access, through exchanges, through trade union exchanges and teacher exchanges and student exchanges and all those things. But you can't do any of that while there's a war and a military occupation going on. Now, it's certainly true that the U.S. invasion and occupation set in motion a bunch of processes in the country which are not going to disappear overnight when the U.S. occupation disappears, if it ever does. And that's one of the worst things that is part of the legacy of our occupation. The years, particularly in 2005, 6, and 7, the years of incredible sectarian bloodletting that our occupation set in motion, that's not going to disappear when our troops are pulled out. But the bottom line is that's an issue that Iraqis first are going to have to deal with on their own. Is it going to be easy? Of course not. Is it going to be pretty? God, no. It's going to be an ugly, brutal fight. And we're probably not going to like very much about how it gets resolved. But you know what? It's not up to us. We've done enough damage. Let's limit the damage. Get the military out. Then we can begin to work with Iraqi civil society. Now, who may face a government that's open and democratic and supportive, and may face a government that is narrow-minded and sectarian and nationalistic or tribalistic or many other things. But they're going to have to sort that out for themselves.
I mean, one of the things that I guess when I look at what's left in Iraq, the 50,000 and the contractors, which we haven't touched on, I mean, the issue of contractors, I think Bill Quigley wrote a really good piece for Common Dreams about that, Bill Quigley and Laura Raymond together.
The Center for Constitutional Rights.
Yes, right, exactly. What we're not talking about is the role of the contractors and how that growth has happened exponentially.
Well, there's two problems that we face right this minute with the contractors. One is the growth of contractors on the ground right now. There's different numbers I've heard. It's somewhere, I've heard 75,000, I've heard 87,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the exact number. It's probably in a range somewhere in between those two. That's huge. That, you know, now the reality is the majority of them are not foreign. The majority of them are Iraqis. So they're not all foreign mercenaries. Some of them are Iraqi mercenaries. But many of them are also foreign contractors who are not armed, who are not the Blackwaters and the Canopies and those that have carried out so many attacks on civilians. They're people who work for the U.S. military, doing things that in any normal army, in any normal war, would be done by the low-ranking privates and corporals. They clean the barracks, they wash the clothes, they cook the meals, they fuel the trucks, they drive the cars. And they are mainly very low-paid workers from places like the Philippines and Bangladesh, other countries of South Asia, who are treated terribly. Often their passports are taken away from them. It's almost like indentured servitude in many cases. So these are real victims. These are not bad guys like these Blackwater people. And then there's another chunk, which is somewhere around 25,000, that are the Blackwaters and their ilk, who are armed and are carrying out this unaccountable war. So that's a huge problem. The other problem that we face right now is that what's already underway, the shift that President Obama did not refer to in his speech the other night, he talked about the transition from U.S. control to Iraqi control. That's all very well and good, but the reality is far different. The reality is there is indeed a shift underway, but it's not the shift from U.S. to Iraqi control. It's the shift from the Pentagon to the State Department. And instead of that meaning an end to military engagement and a replacement with diplomacy, what we're seeing instead is the militarization of U.S. diplomacy in Iraq. And in that context, the mercenaries play a huge role. There's 7,000 new armed mercenaries coming in under the pay of the State Department, not the Pentagon, who are there to guard the State Department employees, guard the enormous embassy that has been built, the largest embassy complex in the world, the size of Vatican City, designed to hold 5,000 diplomats and other people. And now we find out there will be 7,000 mercenaries coming in, armed mercenaries, to serve as a military force. The State Department is also bringing in, it's buying planes, it's buying drones, surveillance drones. It's arranging a military quick reaction force all its own. It's buying armored cars. So what we're seeing is that in the long run, the military work is going to be done by the people who are supposed to be diplomats. And the significance of that is that the U.S.-Iraqi agreement that in theory, according to what President Obama reminded us the other night, calls for all U.S. troops and all Pentagon-paid contractors to leave Iraq by December 31st, 2011, says nothing about contractors in the pay of the State Department. It doesn't say U.S.-paid contractors. It says Defense Department contractors. Very clever move. So you get to transfer military jobs to the State Department. Commander-in-Chief Hillary Clinton.
And to what end do you think? I mean, the numbers of those forces...
No, it means a permanent presence for as long as the U.S. wants and as long as there's a government in Baghdad prepared to accept it. You know, the one thing that's significant about that agreement is that it does say that mercenaries... Well, it doesn't say mercenaries. It says contractors.
Contractors, right.
That in the future, contractors will, after 2011... will be accountable to Iraqi law, Iraqi criminal law, which is important because so far they're accountable to no one. The U.S. can't hold them accountable under military law, and the Iraqis don't hold them accountable, not least because they're better armed than the Iraqi police and the Iraqi military. That's still going to be the case. In theory, they will be accountable to the Iraqi judicial system. In practice, that may mean that some of them leave if they don't like it, but on the other hand, it's also true that, number one, they're better armed than the police, and number two, a company can always just pull out guys who have been involved in some dicey move rather than allow them to stand trial. And that could go on, theoretically, for five generations without violating the existing SOFA agreement.
In all of this, you know, when you look at Afghanistan, you remember the article that came out in the New York Times about... the mineral wealth of Afghanistan. Over the summer, there was this article that it was about the immense wealth of minerals, gold, kinds of minerals we use in our cell phones, other things that are in Afghanistan.
Right.
The Chinese are already there exploiting that. Mm-hmm. You see the new oil drilling and military bases for Afghanistan in places like Azerbaijan. You look at the oil that exists in Iraq, and you never hear those discussions in the roles in the kind of political analysis of what's really going on here. And I'm not
right. The irony, of course, in Iraq right now is that the oil contracts that have been signed and that are being implemented have not brought national wealth; they've brought greater sectarian divide.
Right.
They're breeding more violence, not more wealth. In Afghanistan, frankly, I know there's some Chinese companies investigating, but I think it's going to be actually a very long time before those newly discovered or at least newly acknowledged mineral deposits are going to be accessible. The level of development for a major mining country takes generations.
Right.
And Afghanistan is very far from that. The kinds of roads you need, the kind of equipment you need, the access you need, none of which is possible in Afghanistan and won't be for the next, far more than the next decade, I would say.
Well, but from your perspective then, is this move to stay inside of Iraq from your analysis or what's going on in Afghanistan, which we'll talk about in the next half hour, is it purely a geopolitical move? I'm curious, what do you think is fueling?
Wars were begun for geopolitical reasons. They had to do with oil and natural gas. They had to do with location. For Iraq, that means the centerpiece of a very strategic region. For Afghanistan, it means an area without massive oil and gas deposits of its own, but right at the surrounded by countries rich in oil and natural gas. And it's about bases, both of which play a key role in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's about the expansion of U.S. power. Now, the trajectories obviously were different. In Afghanistan, the issue of the pipelines were always known, were always in the backdrop. We know the history. We know the role of somebody like Zalmay Khalilzad, the former U.S. ambassador first to Iraq, then the ambassador to Afghanistan, then the ambassador to the United Nations. But he has a much earlier history in the 1980s when he was a consultant for UNICAL, around the same time that Hamid Karzai, the current president of Afghanistan, was also a consultant for UNICAL. Zalmay Khalilzad, who's an Afghan-American, was assigned to go to Kabul in 1996, shortly after the Taliban consolidated their power, and bring the Taliban delegation to Houston to meet with oil company executives to talk about pipelines. Now, at that time, nobody seemed to mind that the Taliban was a brutal, misogynistic group that was treating people under its rule terribly. Nobody minded that. It was only later that it became convenient to raise the human rights violations of the Taliban. So, in my view, the 2001 invasion of Afghanistan, the October 7, 2001 invasion of Afghanistan, was not directly to get the pipelines. That was a political move. That was an ideological and political expression of where the U.S. stood in the world, and it was making that announcement through military force, very much as Bush 1 had done in the wake of the Cold War in the first invasion of Iraq in 1991. So, you know, I think we have to be very careful in how we talk about the oil, the natural gas. They are factors. They're not necessarily the immediate driving factor. I think in Iraq, it was the issue of oil was much more immediate than was the pipeline issue in Afghanistan. But in both cases, it's certainly a factor in continuing the war.
So I'm curious. I know that you're not Prussian, but have great analysis in the work that you do. And I'm just curious where you think this policy takes us next.
I'm afraid it takes us to continuing U.S. isolation, continuing fear in this country. I think the mosque debate, the debate that's not really about a mosque but is being talked about as a debate about the mosque in New York, has everything to do with reclaiming the fear factor around 9/11. You know, at the end of the day, I think one of the gains that the right-wing, racist, Islamophobic forces that are trying to stop the building of the Islamic Community Center in New York, one of the great advantages to them is that to the degree that people remember that we use the terms like holy ground, sacred ground, these are terms that immediately apply from the land, that if ground zero, even that term is obviously troubling, but if we, whatever we want to call it, if that land is sacred ground, then the wars fought to avenge that attack become sacred wars. It becomes much harder to oppose those wars. So I'm afraid we're seeing a significant pushback in this country, a reclaiming of fear, a paralysis that has everything to do with the economic crisis, and we don't hear enough from President Obama and others about the links. We don't hear that the cost of the escalation in Afghanistan, the $33 billion, that Congress just voted, claiming that they were all against the war, but only 108 of the Democrats and one Republican voted against the funding. Seven Republicans, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
They still voted $33 billion. That $33 billion could have paid for 660,000 new green union jobs. You know, keeping one soldier in Afghanistan for 1 year costs $1.2 million. Not that the young soldier gets that.
Right, right.
For everything else. That same amount of money, you could hire that soldier and 23 more for that same money. You know, so what we're dealing with here is a huge elephant in the room that says there's a link between why we don't have jobs, why we don't have decent health care, and the cost of the wars. That's why on October 2nd, at the huge mobilization in Washington, focusing on, it's the
One Nation
Working Together mobilization led by the NAACP and National Council of La Raza and SEIU, DC-37, and the AFL-CIO, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a peace table within it. The demands include the demand for peace abroad and justice at home. And the peace table, last time I checked, has about 150 or so organizations that have signed on. There's a whole separate website that is onenationforpeace.org. And the reason for that is that there's a link here. The military budget costs jobs. The wars are impoverishing this country as well as it is destroying Afghanistan and destroying Iraq and destroying the lives of so many young soldiers and so many hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and Afghans.
Phyllis Bennis, it's always a pleasure to have you on the air with us, and I do appreciate it. And
Thanks very much.
It's great. And folks, we will be covering One Nation pretty intensely over this next month until that demonstration and be broadcasting from there here in WEA with Free Speech TV and be covering all that. Phyllis Bennis, once again, thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, author of the books Ending the War in Iraq, a Primer, Ending the War in Afghanistan, a Primer. As I said earlier, as we went into this, this was going to be a debate, but the liberal think tank folks who we had lined up at the last minute could not make it, but we'll bring that debate to you soon. And when we come back from this break, we'll be joined by Fahima Vorgetz, who is an Afghan-American who just came back from Afghanistan last night. And she will be joining us here to talk about her experiences there and what is going on in Afghanistan. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, the website is www.mecu.com. We'll be right back.